Hello, welcome to the
Ember Map Podcast.
Next.js, no. Welcome to Front End First. Dude, just find someone on Fiverr to just like auto-tune our voices.
Why don't we just find someone on Fiverr to do the whole podcast? Okay. Just use the AI thing and auto-tune our voices. We've automated our podcast production. You know there's Instagram accounts that have like 400,000 followers that are generated by Epic Games? There's like these fake bot accounts that like generate their content and their like pictures and stuff. It's like a cartoon character, but they it's all generated. That's what they said. And they have like 400,000 followers. It's just like someone programmed it, sits back and watch the followers grow.
I'm so confused.
It's like it'd be like a anime girl character at like the beach, and then she's like running.
Traveling. Of course, it's friggin' anime. Of course.
You know, even during a pandemic, Sophia, whatever her name is, can just go travel the world. She's like at Yellowstone last week, and like this week she's in Japan. I don't know who follows her.
Apparently I sure you.
Dude, I've been watching Ted Lasso.
It's amazing.
I only met a few episodes in, but I really like it. It's really funny. He reminds me of my brother-in-law a little bit.
Yeah,
because he's from the South, Dan is, and he's just like a funny guy in just those situations, just those normal situations, but he can just be charming and like funny, you know? It's really good. I like it.
It's a great show.
Yeah. They're good. I watched that one, Servant, too. I like that show. It was creepy, but it was good. But the Amazon or the Apple stuff is pretty good so far that I like.
We've only watched Ted Lasso.
It is hilarious, though. Great premise, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like a redneck from like, where is he from? Mississippi or something like that?
Yeah.
Arkansas?
Sure.
All the same. Put him in England. Yeah, it's good.
It's great because he knows just as much about soccer as we, an American audience knows. Yeah, so true. It's so good.
The journalists are asking him, like, tell us what the offside rule are. And you're like, I'm wondering what he's going to say because I feel just as dumb as him right now. It's great. Yeah, it's fun having like a sitcom-ish to watch because like they don't make sitcoms like Friends anymore, really, you know? And it's fun to just have something that's not like, all right, we have to like turn the lights out and really prepare for
like the movie Daredevil version
because
of
this
TV
is
show,
like
yeah.
going to be super intense. Yeah, exactly. It's like a movie. It's funny though. What we got going on here? Oh, we are supposed to introduce ourselves. I'm Sam. This is Ryan. Say hi, Ryan.
Hi.
You're supposed to say, hi, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan. Look at that joke. Oh, boy.
I'm not even of the two of us, you're more the dad. I guess you can't be, it's like being more or less pregnant. You either are or you're not. But if you could be gradients of dadness, you wouldn't in that category. But I'm Sam. That's Ryan. We like to talk, if you're just joining us for the first time, we like to talk about front end stuff, which is why our podcast is called Front End First. So welcome aboard. We've been hacking with Next.js a bunch, and Next 10 came out this week. There was a conference on Tuesday. It was pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. We joined for a little bit. Did you watch any of the talks yet?
No, just what we watched on Tuesday.
Yeah. There's some that I definitely want to watch. I heard the frame of motion one was good. And there's like a deep dive on the image component, which we'll talk about.
Sweet.
Cause that thing is awesome. What else from Next 10 was exciting?
I just upgraded, yesterday upgraded a Next app. It was like 9.3 and I went to Next 10. You just did the same with your blog.
Yeah, yeah.
The big thing for me, and I think this was before Next 10, was fast refresh. Mm. It's better than the hot module reload or whatever I had there before.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one.
That was a big thing you noticed since
you had productivity improvement. Yeah,
right.
What's new?
That was a cool thing because when I did my video last week on the dropdown with headless UI, I just toggled it and it opened, and then I went back to my code and started adding Tailwind classes, and I didn't have to like, you know, in an older video I wanted it to just show. So I made like a toggle function that sets the state, or like you default it to true because you want the menu to start open. But like,
yes,
you don't even have to do that
yeah.
if you're just adding classes, which is awesome.
Yep.
I even remember like, I'm trying to remember if it was Ember or React where Remember how, actually it was old school Ember, I think, that had hot style reloading where we used to write CSS and BEM. And then when we started using Tailwind, we lost it because it would do the whole thing. So I remember that being like a really crappy thing. But now it's like best of both worlds.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I don't know exactly the difference between fast refresh and hot module reload, but I do know enough when I'm working and I alt tab and it's like, oh, okay.
Right.
No errors. Right. State is preserved. It's right. Usually they're super fast.
That would be fun to do like a deep dive on that or like learn about it. Cause I saw Dan Abramoff tweeting about it and I think he's just been working on and thinking about it a lot.
Cool.
He was saying, did you see all that going back to like 2014 or whatever? Even Redux was about this idea. And then they tried to do it with hot module reloading. And then fast refresh was really driven by React Native because the build times in native development, I think, are a lot higher. So it's like way, way more important, you know, if you have to refresh a site, but it takes like a half a second. We've been doing that for years, right? Yep. But I think the build times in a big iOS app or React Native app can be slow.
Interesting.
So I think that was the main driver.
Also, too, with a web app, we have a URL, so we preserve some state.
Yes.
Or a mobile app, that might be harder to serialize we kind of get that for free.
Yeah. I love when that happens, though, when like something that doesn't make sense for like smaller people, but like the bigger company needs it, but then something comes out of it that's makes everyone's life better.
Yes.
It's just like the best. It's so cool. The image component was new. We'll talk about that. Internationalized routing. And then next, analytics and commerce. That was kind of interesting. You know, for me, the commerce stuff doesn't really solve like any immediate problems I'm having, but I was just keeping an eye on the next chat in Discord and people were like stoked about that. I think there's been people who've been building e-commerce stuff for, you know, a year or two on Next. So these are probably the people that helps the most.
Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, I don't know anyone this helps.
Yeah.
And I went on Twitter and a friend of mine was like, this is going to save me so much time.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh,
oops. Maybe I do know someone. I think it's called a starter kit. A commerce starter kit. I think there might be other kits coming. So I think they might be making other starter kits.
Very cool.
Blog starter kit, SaaS starter kit, stuff like that. So that could be really awesome. I'd like an app starter kit with like a database.
Like I would opinionated just like whatever app I'm working layer. On starter
kit. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Oh yeah. So okay, get static props and get server side props have fast refresh now, which is pretty awesome. So I'm guessing like if you were to change that, they rerun those hooks on the server and they...
Oh, your client would like re-request the data?
I guess. Or if it got props. Doesn't it get those as props?
Yeah.
So it would just rerun your client code, but you wouldn't lose any ephemeral React state. You would just get like a new payload from like your backend or like Mirage or something like that. We should try that out. That'd be pretty cool.
Super cool.
And fast refresh for MDX. Also cool.
Nice.
Importing CSS from third-party React components from NPM. That's cool.
So oh, you know
that's,
what?
That's like the thing that we were running into on my site where I had Reach Dialog CSS.
I ran into this in one of my apps.
Really?
Where I needed like a global style that was provided by some third-party component, and I couldn't get it imported. There was something like it had to be imported. That was it. It had to be imported in like the root and it couldn't be imported in a page.
Mm.
And there was an issue and I got on like some beta branch and I got the problem fixed. But this must
be what that
solve that. Nice. Like this must be the it merged into main.
Yeah, I like that these days when I set up a new project with Tailwind, I just import. If you just import like in JavaScript from Tailwind CSS / Tailwind.css, that's directly from the NPM package and you don't have to customize it at all, which I never do. The only reason I make a styles file is to like do at Tailwind utilities, space or whatever it is. But all that was implementation details from my perspective. And I usually don't write any CSS if I can avoid it. Or if I do, I'm going to do it in line using like style components or something like that.
What if you want to edit the Tailwind config?
That still works. So
you can
the Tailwind config is at your root, and then when Tailwind runs, I don't know how it builds it, but it does.
Really?
It's a good question, actually. I think, oh no, I know how. The Tailwind CSS file in the package is literally just that base file that says at import or at tailwind, whatever the three things.
Mm-hmm.
And those are post-CSS like directives. So if post-CSS is in your chain, which Next supports by out of the box, so you have a post-CSS config, hits tailwind, and it finds that that's your CSS, and then it runs all your tailwind stuff. So when the post-CSS tailwind plugin runs that is tailwind, it's going to look at your config. So you're good to go.
Okay. I think I literally have a tailwind.css that is just literally those three. Yeah.
So you can just replace that, get rid of that whole thing, and then wherever, probably underscore app.js, you're importing styles.css, you can just import it directly from there. And on my personal site, I think I have the reach dialog styles as well. But now I can just do it in app.js.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need that style CSS file anymore.
Cool.
Which I like. Yeah, you made an interesting point. We were playing around with the dialog, the dropdown, and the menu from Headless UI. And it's just so easy to use. And I love that it's just a React component and you just import it and use it. Autocomplete and everything. And it was just a nice... That's just a small improvement over the reach dialog, because the reach dialog has this weird setup where you have to like import the base styles and then you're like overriding them and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think as far as APIs go that I like, you know, that was pretty sweet.
Yeah. It's not that the reach one is like wrong.
Yeah.
It's just it's you have to learn it.
Right.
You have to learn how to configure it.
Right.
Where with the I haven't used Headless UI, so I don't know, but like, you know, when you're in React land composing components.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I wonder if there's any styles. I think there must be some CSS that comes with it. So I wonder how they like inject maybe it. Like, and I wonder if it's a problem for certain ways you would build it. But I'm guessing it's like it can just leverage all the code splitting tooling around the JavaScript stuff. So, you know, because that's how like Ember modal dialog worked too. You had to import like the base for the structure, because you need certain things to be a certain way, and the Z index for it to work and everything like that. So that's interesting. Automatic resolving of href, but as properties.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
That was one of the things, once I upgraded, that was one of the things I went through. I didn't do it. I had some confusing ones where I had a component that based on the URL, that its links might be different. So I was customizing both the href and the as.
Oh, that's
and
annoying.
So there were like two ternaries. And so just being able to go down to href was just
nice.
So sweet.
Nice. So with href, you can just do like /user/template/string/user/id.
Yep.
And it'll just go to the right place.
Yeah. I think in the docs, they say something like it will recognize most URLs, but it can't recognize everything. So there's probably things where you can do like, you can do like, I think you can do like double brackets and then like dot, 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 slug.
Oh.
And that's like match everything, like slashes. It's like a wild card.
Gotcha.
So you might, I don't have any of those in my app, but I imagine there might be some situations where you want to provide link some help, some more information.
Got you.
But yeah, for my app, it was just
all
down href.
That is awesome. There's a code mod. Easy access to Next code mods. I upgraded my site from 9 to 10, and we didn't use a code mod. We did it together yesterday, and there was also like no upgrade guide. And so I went to the Discord, and people were like, where's the upgrade guide? What's the change log? Because it's a major release, so you would expect there to be some breaking changes, but maybe there weren't any. So as far as we could tell, there were some people who were running into things, but nothing that was documented. So I think right now the upgrade is to just upgrade it and see if anything breaks, you know? But the code mod thing is cool. You know, we know that from Ember. And it's like awesome.
Yeah. I didn't use the code mod on my upgrade, but I did notice that I had a bunch of page components that were anonymous functions. And when my Next app was building, it would say,
it'd be good to name them.
Yeah. You should name them. And then I think there was a line about if you want, you can run the code mod for this. But I went in and I didn't have that many, and it was easy enough to just rename them.
Got you. And then blocking fallback for get static paths. Wait on pre-rendering when generating new static pages instead of serving a static fallback page.
Yeah. I want to play with this. I think that you know how like you can edit some data and then visit a page get the cache copy.
Yeah.
And then it regenerates in the background.
Like my work journal.
Yeah, your work journal. I think now you can say it's blocking and they generate that at request time. But I'm not sure because how is that different than...
It says it's forget static paths. So it's like maybe let's say you had a dynamic blog route and you have get static paths. And you generate all the paths at build time because I know I only have these 20 MDX files in my thing. Okay,
this, you're making sense now.
The fallback property allows for generating additional static pages without needing a full rebuild. The past few months, we've received a lot of feedback from companies that want a similar but slightly different behavior, a blocking pre-render when a user requests a page for the first time.
So maybe you don't get
so
like
you go
the
to blog slash
dynamic segment.
Yeah, blog slash my first next app. It's a blog post we know exists. And instead of serving a fallback,
well, instead of serving
yeah,
like
you
a
wouldn't
shell,
want to fall back.
Instead
yeah.
of serving a
yeah,
shell,
yeah, the cache page doesn't make as much sense in that case. Whereas the cache page for my work journal, which is a stable URL that just is showing stale data, makes sense. If you're missing one entry, you'd still rather the people get it quick and then get the fresh version the next time. But if you go to a dynamic URL segment that hasn't been built ahead of time, so it's almost like pre-generating static site, but not at build time, at runtime. It's just rendering it on the server. At request
but
time,
then, but, then, not, but then, but then, it ends up in cache.
Ends up in the cache. It's just that the first time they want to just pause on it, basically.
You're saying that this would
so fallback. So what's the difference between fallback blocking, which is what this new thing is, versus not having fallback at all? Oh, because then it doesn't take the cache. Okay, so I think I understand. If get static paths is just an async function, it will always run
at build time.
At build time? Yeah, at build time.
So this is a way for you to have...
And then they added fallback true, which is runtime. I'm actually not sure. We have to just play with this.
Yeah.
Enables blocking mode for the fallback behavior. That enables the blocking behavior where no static fallback is sent to the browser. Instead, the initial request is waited on for pre-rendering.
I think you get a request. It's not in the cache. It's something that can be server generated. So you would serve the app shell and generate in the background, mm-hmm. right?
That's fallback true. If the fallback is true, then the behavior changes. If paths returned will be rendered HTML build time. Paths that have not been generated build time will not result in a 404 page. Instead, next will serve a fallback version of the page in the background. Next will statically generate. When it's done, the browser receives a JSON for the generated path. This will be used to automatically render the page with the required props. From the user's perspective, the page will be swapped from the fallback page to the full page.
Yeah.
So it's rendering a shell for
so
dynamic
shell,
segments.
And then it generates, puts it in the cache, and gives it to the browser.
So you could say loading blog post or something like that for people who miss cache.
Right.
Got you.
Where then, this would just be blocking, so you can not serve the shell. You wait until the server is done, put it in the cache, and then serve it to the user.
I wonder why people would want to do that. Because presumably there's a reason that new page...
Could be for I'm not sure, like maybe SEO or something. You don't like if you have a segment. Again, this is stuff. I feel uncomfortable commenting on this because I haven't used this. So
yeah,
It would be good. It would be good to see what the use case for this is.
Yep, I agree. Okay, cool. Yeah, interesting. It would be good to know why you wouldn't want to serve up the thing. Maybe like what you said.
We really.
It's like you're linking to some obscure product page on Amazon, because that's what they were talking about as an example. Amazon has like millions of products.
You're not going to pre-build.
You're going to pre-build the first 20 on the homepage, let's say, but you want to use the same like route for each one because it's all the same. So you pre-build 20 and get static paths. You just return like the top ones, and then people can just hit any product. And then if you want to make them wait for it the first time, you use that fallback true or fallback blocking, and then it ends up in the cache so that other people get it after that. It's basically different strategies for dealing with a cache miss.
It'd be good to, especially with Next and all the ways you can generate server rendered pages, it'd be good to have a little table. This is what this does. This is why you would use this.
Yeah, because now it feels like between all three of those modes, you don't need all of them. Like there's probably one way that, or two ways that you could do it that would make the most sense. It's like once you have incremental static site generation, you don't need to wait at build time. Yeah, I just wonder if some of the new things have replaced some of the older ways to do it. Like you said, a table, that's like, do the other options still make sense, or are they effectively like deprecated in that there's like they're not better in any situation?
There's always a use case.
Well, like they basically said that about get server side props or the right
get or the other one.
Yeah, the original one.
Get static props.
Yeah. Get initial props.
Get initial props.
It's like there's no reason to use it anymore because there's better stuff for every case you would use it for now. Since we're talking about this, I was going to bring up, I was talking to my friend Chris Toomey, and he shared this little video of someone from the Haskell community. You probably would know who it was.
I probably wouldn't.
Probably like, it might have been the language. It was like people who work on languages. Like it might be, you know, one of the guys who worked on it. Simon Peyton Jones.
Oh, yeah. SPJ. That's probably the only, there's like three people in Haskell I know.
That's exactly why I said that.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Haskell. It's just like a little 6-minute impromptu conversation he was having with some other people, but he drew this chart of like useful and useless languages and effectful and like effect free languages. Have you seen that? And
is it old? If it's new, I haven't.
I think it's from like 6 or 7 years ago.
Okay.
It's just a little 6-minute video.
Yeah, maybe. He does. Yes. I probably have seen that. There was like a period where I went on binge with that stuff.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So who is he? He created Haskell?
I don't know if he created it. I think he worked on the compiler or works on the compiler.
Gotcha.
He's like one of the big, he's like charismatic, great speaker.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like a fun academic.
Yes.
Like the 1% of teachers that I like.
Yeah.
But he drew this thing and it was like, useful's up here, useless is down here. And then on the X axis, it's like effectful and effect free. So you put Haskell in the bottom right, which is effect free and useless.
Yeah.
And then you put like every other mainstream language is up here, which is useful and effectful, like side effects everywhere, basically. Like any part of your program can mutate state. And so, you know, C sharp and C and Java and all that stuff. And he said, these guys are moving this way. So they're moving to have less effects. So they're like embracing, you know, functional ideas and while still trying to be useful, you know. Mm-hmm. And Haskell, he was like, oh, we're taking a page from like some of these people's books or whatever and figuring out how to have side effects in a way that doesn't contaminate your entire program. So we're moving up, but we're both moving towards this corner, but from two different sides. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And then what Chris was saying when we were just having a little back and forth on email, we were talking about SPAs and versus like server rendering and stuff and how complex SPAs are. And he was like, I feel like there's an analogy here where like the back end and the front end frameworks and libraries are also trying to converge on the same thing of making like rich user experiences, but they're coming at it from different angles. We've been building SPAs for a long time now. The like you can say the pure version is like an Ember app, let's say, on the client, or a Create React app, which is just running on the client. And you lose all this stuff you get from the back end stuff, but you have all this rich interactivity. And like, whereas a pure Rails app is on the other side of that spectrum. But, you know, the server frameworks have TurboLynx was like original OG kind of version of this, but now it's like Livewire.
I mean, even Inertia, I think.
Inertia, exactly. Livewire is Phoenix or...
There's Livewire and LiveView. Isn't Laravel one of them?
Yeah, exactly. One of them's Laravel. One of them's Elixir or Phoenix. And then now you have like Next.js, which, and then even like, I guess Redwood, but really Next to me fits this category of like coming at it from like, we're starting with a React app and then now we're converging on like getting the server behavior and Remix as well, I would say, because they're doing a lot of the same kinds of things. How can we use HTTP caching? How can we render things on the server at runtime when we need to?
HTTP is part of our framework, is like part of our strategy.
Right.
Or something with like Ember.
Right.
It's not.
Right. Exactly.
Everything's a 200.
Exactly.
The client does all the routing.
Exactly. And rendering.
Yep.
Yep. Exactly. So I thought that was a really interesting like little tidbit. I thought it might be fun to make a video about that, a little video essay, but it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And it's like, who's right, you know, and like which is best. Like, you could talk about the Haskell functional crew who believe in those principles and like hold on to those so tightly, and then say like, that's like a peer way to get there. You could argue like React is a similar kind of thing from the functional approach, where they're saying the purity is what's important. We'll hold on to that and we'll figure out how to make the effects happen given those constraints. So we're starting and operating in a world of these constraints, and those are the most important thing. Then we're going to figure out how to get the mutation to happen. Whereas an OOP flavor would say the API for the programmer on making mutations is the number one thing. So we're going to give you a user model like in Rails, and you're going to be able to say user.firstname equals user.safe. And like, that's where we're starting from. And then like, that's the most important thing, because that's what the programmer is writing. And we're going to go back from there and figure out how to make it work. Mm-hmm. But like, I haven't written Haskell, but I just feel like, given my exposure, based on my exposure to the functional programming principles, mostly in things like React, it's like, no, the value is not like, we would rather give up convenience on the API that you're writing and make you understand what you're doing. It's actually important for you to understand what a pure function is, because that's the more important thing. And so we're going to make you learn it, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas again, you look at that DHH thing where he's like, you can write a Rails app without really knowing what's happening. It feels like a completely different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that would be a fun video to make, but it's also just kind of, I thought that was a super interesting insight from Chris. It's like, eventually these things might look very similar. Like, take a React app with use effect that's like functionally pure and has like your effects everywhere, and now it's doing this concurrent mode thing in the future sometime where render frames are being dropped. Like, is there really that much difference between that and like a Haskell program? Like, conceptually, maybe they look very, very similar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you could almost say like, but I guess, does it look different from, you know, where something like Ember is going or something like Rails is going? I mean, I guess.
Yeah. I like what you said about the API point, like in, you know, React right now, you have to know about purity and effects and when they happen, but maybe you can see a future where that stuff is all hidden from you.
Right.
Right. Right. It starts to become more useful in the sense that like they're use on screen, use window size. Like, that's like kind of like the first version of usefulness.
Yeah.
You're not
writing
an effect to manage those things. You're just importing a package.
Yeah. Cause I believe it's true that like the functional people would say, no, like you need to understand what is pure and where your effects are so that you can write software better. I don't think it's fair to say that they don't want to stop improving APIs and making them easier to use. So like, the goals are the same, to end up with good APIs that make it easy to use and that are good abstractions that make it so you don't have to understand how everything works. So today we live in a world where you really have to understand like what use effect does if you're going to write a React app, but there might be a world where you don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that world will, I think my understanding at least is like, React core team would want, is still going to push for use effect and purity and all that, but by exposing APIs for framework library authors, we can build up, so we as app developers can use frameworks that hide all that use effect for stuff from us.
Right.
I don't see React ever getting rid of use effect.
Right.
Yeah.
So we were also talking this week about some of this stuff, and something interesting that came up was Sebastian's gist about purity, but also we saw some commentary on Twitter about people who were frustrated. Dan was asking what should be in the docs. Dan Abramov was asking what's missing, what do you think is missing from the React docs? And there were some people saying things like, we wish there was more of your opinions there, because it feels like there's a lot of unspoken rules in React. So it's related to this idea, how much does the developer, how much is expected to be known by the developer when writing a React app to be successful? And like, you definitely read about purity in the docs and everything, but it's easy because React is pretty low level. Again, there's like three APIs they give you, right? And it's pretty low level. it's easy to put those together in ways that they were not intended to be. So because it's so low level, it doesn't really tie your hands too much. It's very easy to write a React app that works for your expected behavior, but you are actually misusing it. You're mutating something in a render function. You're not putting something in an effect where it should be, even omitting dependencies. And so a lot of people were saying things like, you know, if you're going to give us the ability to like hang ourselves or whatever with the rope, that you need to tell us what to do in the guides. And I thought that was a really interesting conversation because like there's parts of, you know, DHH has said this about Rails before. And he says, like, if you're not going to take the time to learn how to do it right, then I don't have time to answer your questions. Basically, like there's a right way to build a Rails app. We don't want to treat you like children and make it so you can't have enough power, but you're going to have to learn how to use these things. But you can always have an answer for every question basically by going to the Rails guides, because they're going to tell you this is how you do it.
Yep.
Whereas React might not have that. That was where some of the frustration was coming from. So I thought that was interesting and I agreed with it.
Yeah. I think, yes. I have nothing to add to this. It's a strong yes. Like,
yeah. I mean, what's like an example, when we reread that old gist, the thing about setting state is a side effect, but then we were just looking at the get derived state from props conversation we had last week. And so that's a question. Is that something that hypothetically would break with concurrent mode or just in general violate the principles that you're supposed to understand when you're writing React code? And the answer is like, we don't actually know, because you're not going to find that anywhere in the docs. You might find, again, Sebastian talking about it in a gist from a couple of years ago, who's on the core team, so that means something, but you're going to find lots of like private conversations and Twitter messages about it. But yeah, that's kind of like a incoherent part of the experience.
Yeah, I think there's definitely different categories of things. So like just starting super simple, like how to make a dropdown, right? Mm-hmm. Like how data should flow in and out of components. That's the things like most experienced developers know how to answer. The answers are all going to be the same. Mm-hmm. But I still think that would be valuable to see in the docs. I think like the tutorial does a great job at this. Like there's a bunch of stuff where if you're new to React, where you don't mutate state, you create copies of state and set that new state.
Right.
Like that's really great to see that stuff.
Right. Right.
So I think that's one. I think kind of like real world examples of how to use fetch in a React app. Like, how should you use it? Do you use like abort controller? Do you do something like is mounted and then in your then, so you check if you're still mounted? Just how to think about those async effects.
Right.
And then I think the third.
Yeah, that's a really good one, because the is mounted thing, I only do it the way I did it is because I saw Dan tweet about a very specific way that he does it. And that's how I do it now.
Yeah. The third, I think, is the stuff that's like, it works in my app.
Mm-hmm.
There is no code path in my app that will make this a bug, but there's something.
Something or someone is telling me it's wrong.
Right. So this would be like setting document.title during render, right? That's like obvious. We know that that's wrong, but like why, like seriously, why is it wrong? Well, it makes your component not pure. Why does that matter?
Right.
I can show you an app where I do that and you can't put it in a bad state. Now, right. I always, document.title, I know enough
right.
that this needs to go into effect. Right. So every time I do that, it's in an effect. Actually, I just use some like React title library, but
under the hood, they're doing that.
Right. Now. But I would like to understand.
Yeah.
I would like to see things along like these are things you could do, but they'll bite you, especially along the lines of concurrent mode.
Yeah.
I don't know if I think there's maybe some hesitation here because we don't, concurrent mode still being worked on.
Yeah.
Suspense is still being worked on. None of that's finalized. But I would still like to see examples of that sort of stuff. Like this is...
No, that was absolutely perfect. Like the story you just told is absolutely perfect. And document title is just a super simple case. And it's like, but why? You have to know why it messes up. The set timeout thing, Dan goes through detail in his post why it can break in ways that are like subtle and why it's better if it is like respects the data flow. So that's the kind of thing that could be maybe reduced and explained in the docs,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, the classic component did mount bug.
Yeah,
with exactly. the friend idea that changed. They do such a good job.
Exactly.
And we've all hit that.
Exactly.
So yes.
Exactly.
More of those examples would be fun.
Yep.
It would just be
totally
awesome.
Totally. Yeah, because you want to be like you want to write pure function because it sounds like it's the right thing to do, and you've seen it in other contexts where it's helped, but it's not always clear when it comes to like rendering why. it is the way it is.
Yeah, along just one more along those lines, like things like mutating a ref during render. Like sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes you end up doing that. Things like I'm using a new date. I need to display new date during render. So how should I think about that?
Mm-hmm. Right. Because reading from date during render is wrong.
It's not pure. It's not
but why? Pure. And it's like, why? What's the issue? Right.
Where does this bite me? Right. What are the concurrent mode steps that this bites me? It's not so much like, oh, I don't have that problem, so I don't need to follow it. Just right. To give me an understanding.
Yep, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the image component and then move on to questions. Cool. We've been babbling already for 30 minutes. So yeah, the image component was like the big thing from Next 10, at least for me it was. I'm going to make a video about it next week. It should be fun. We fixed the images on my homepage. We basically yesterday upgraded my personal site to Next 10, and then I have 4 homepage images and we just swapped them out. It was pretty awesome.
It was super awesome.
It was amazing. I was using like a custom aspect ratio component I had made, which used the padding bottom CSS trick to hold space. And then I was just using, within that, I was just using HTML image. And I hadn't done anything to my images because it didn't really care about it. And so the next image component replaces both pieces. It holds the space. It basically has the padding bottom trick built into it. We saw it in the dev tools. And then you pass it a source. And the only thing you have to do is give it a size. Now, I was thinking about this. I think there's actually PR for this or RFC, but it should be able to just look at the size of the image for you. right? Because especially if it's locally, if it's local.
Yeah.
If it wants the native dimensions of the thing.
I mean, yes, if it's local, maybe it gets a little uncanny because like there's definitely going to be people with remote images.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I was thinking like but maybe if you like import the image and then like import, you know how you can like there's a SVGR where you can import the SVG, but you can also import other things about the SVG, like its URL. So maybe you could like import, you know, the structure height and width from, you know, myphoto.jpg.
You pass it in or something like that. But anyways, the last thing you do is, you just pass in height and width and then that's basically it. And it does a whole bunch of stuff for you. It creates the source set, which is like a newer HTML CSS feature, which I've never written by hand. But basically, if you're using a modern browser, it knows the browser basically gets to choose which version of the image it requests based on the dimensions and the height and the pixel density that it supports.
That's the big thing is it's the pixel density. Right. So the iPhone is going to request a different image than something that's on a small screen.
It's amazing. And it just does all that stuff for you. And then it also does this really cool thing where if it's out of the viewport, it doesn't request it. And then once you scroll within like a certain threshold of it, it requests it. So it's perfect on my homepage because I have one big hero kind of. And then at the bottom, I have like 3 pictures like New York and Boston and stuff. And right now in production, my site loads like 8 megabytes of pictures. As soon as you open it up, no matter what device you're on, no matter what connection you're on. And then with the next image component, it brought it down to, 400 kilobytes and only total. 40 of them were loaded, initially, by the first picture. So that's just awesome. It works by generating the different versions of the image at different quality and sizes at request time, right?
Yep. Yep.
And built into Next 10 is like they use this image... .js or what's the library they use?
Probably like Image Sharp or
whatever. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And it'll just do that at request time and then it'll cache it once it's done. So again, something like the homepage of my site is a perfect use case for this because everyone's seeing the same images. So once I deploy it and this happens, they'll get cached and everyone will get cached versions. So even though it's best of both worlds because you don't generate all these versions of every image on your site at build time and when you start your dev server, which just slows the whole thing, your whole dev process down. But because of the cache, you basically get the same benefit. Your users get the same benefit. The other cool thing is just that it it works when you deploy to Vercel automatically. So like we use ImageX before on like Embermap and other sites, and they do the same kind of thing. But when you like wire up one of these services with your site, it's always kind of a pain in the butt. You have to like, oh, am I going to use absolute URLs to all my images, my app? I want to make it portable. So now I have to prefix it somehow. If I'm going to pre-generate it at server time, I have to prefix it. It's just a pain in the butt. And it's been worse too, where you have to get, you store the images on S3. So you need to actually store the bucket and the key for the image on your data model, so that when you request like a poster for a video on Embermap, you get the key, and then you put that into a function that converts it into a URL on ImageX. So that is just a whole bunch of work, and you literally don't have to do any of that with this.
There's something here where you can look at this and you can be like, look, we've had runtime CDN dynamic and image resizing for the last 6 years. And
there's nothing new here.
There's nothing new, but it's the integration. It's the integration piece. If you're working on an app and you have to go set up ImageX, and it's fine, I can set up ImageX in an app in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's still, there's decisions there that I have to make.
And I never did it on my homepage because my personal site.
Because it's only my personal site. Yeah. I don't need to set up it. Yeah, exactly.
But now I have them.
And then two, if you've ever worked for like a big company, you can't just go set up ImageX.
Right.
You got to talk to like your boss.
Right.
Who has to talk to their boss. Who has to talk to their boss to get like a $10 a month right. subscription.
Exactly.
But you've got to, you get like API keys that you have to configure.
You have to have accounts for everyone so they can sign into your ImageX account.
Where there's something that's so sweet about the Vercel integration. I think the integration is like, we don't need to just say like, oh, everything could do this. Like the integration is the sweet spot of this. You import next image, you use it, and you deploy it, and it just smooths out all that stuff. And it's, it seems simple, but it's one of those things that seems simple, and it saves you so much time. And I think it's a really good point that, like, you know how to set up ImageX, you know how to use ImageX, you weren't using it on your blog.
Yeah, why would I? I mean,
why? You want to just ship your blog, you don't
It's like, really why care. Would I add ARIA roles to my drop-down menu on my site, but now they're there because I'm using Headless UI, and it does all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's just a dang good abstraction. I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah. Don't make like a theoretical argument about what you could do before and what you can't do and all this. It's look at what I was doing and look at what I'm now doing.
Yeah, exactly. It's really amazing. And it's just really, really cool. The deploy part, the back end front end, this goes back to like the blurring the lines there and how Next is like this hybrid framework that's moving in this direction and giving you the kinds of things that you'd only get if you were writing your whole server from scratch using something like Rails or Laravel. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's really, really cool. We asked for questions. I think someone was asking about Gatsby image versus Next image. And oh my gosh, man. Gatsby image, first of all, just from an API perspective.
Can we get a bottle of just scotch before we do this?
I've been meaning to do that, man. I mean, if there's any time that would be justified for us to be sipping on some scotch during a podcast, it's during 2020, during the pandemic, leading up to the election. No question. So we don't have to worry about being judged. They're not going to cancel us. They're not going to take us off the iTunes listing. We're going to get scotch next time. Or peanut butter whiskey, which I've been enjoying and goes down really, really easy. There's also Tennessee honey, which is Jack Daniels.
Oh, I'm sorry I brought this up.
These are delicious. Now I'm just getting excited because it's Friday and I've been pretty healthy this week. So Gatsby image is just, I'm so glad that we're not working on Gatsby sites anymore. Gatsby image, you have to make a GraphQL query. There's two different kinds. You have to know whether you're using a responsive image or not. And then you make this pretty crazy query that you have to go to graphical. It's so funny. I remember when I started this and I thought it was the best. And this is a huge extra step just to render an image. I just want to like give it a source URL, a path. And you use graph.
To be fair, like if you were going to keep using Gatsby, you would eventually, like for an infinite amount of time, you would eventually end up with
an abstraction that lets you pass a source in, for sure. And I basically did that actually on like all three of our Gatsby sites. I think we basically do that. I think if you look at Mirage.js's repo right now, it's just like image component that takes a source. But it's just really confusing. The docs are really weird to me. You make a GraphQL request, you get that response in like use static query, and you like splat this like data back into like Gatsby's image component. So now you're using like two different Gatsby APIs that are in these two different spots. You have to understand. And then because this whole thing is like this weird component that's doing things that you don't understand, if you want to change it, it's really hard and confusing. Whereas again, like the composition with Next Image is nice. It just takes class names. There's no weird wrapper things going on. I made it rounded, no problem, like my old one was. So, and the Gatsby stuff is build time only, so it crushes your builds.
Yes.
And you're sitting there running Gatsby dev and waiting for all of the thumbnails to be regenerated, and you're like, why am I doing this?
I worked on a Gatsby app that had a lot of images this summer. It wasn't even a lot. Like, people would say, like, their builds take 30 minutes. I was nowhere near that. But they were big images that were source images that we need to resize.
Yeah.
The dev stuff, it does cache it. So if the image hasn't changed, it won't have to rebuild every single time. But, I mean, come on,
CI, different boxes for branch builds.
Yes. And you end up blowing away your cache once a week at least.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
the build, like when you deploy in CI, you want to run in a new container, and it's hard to, you can cache that stuff, but there might be friction there. And So the runtime
is just really nice. Yeah, it's really, really nice.
Also too, one of the things I had to work on with Gatsby image was that source set thing. And so I was making a query to, you can make a query, GraphQL query to Gatsby with, input. With like GraphQL input variables to say the sizes you want. So you can say like 700W, 1200W, and then get back a bunch of source set images. But I actually had to read the MDM docs on source set
to understand what the heck you were doing.
To what I was supposed to do with that stuff. And it's funny, I remember finishing it and being like, it works, but I don't really, there's like just a lot here.
Weird syntax. Yeah. It's just like a lot.
So, yeah, I would say the Gatsby stuff is more low level, more moving pieces, more to understand. Not more low level in the sense that there's a high level bits like the Gatsby image. Just more you have to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Cool. Let's hit some of these questions. Twitter. How are you liking Twitter these days? What are your feelings about Twitter.com?
I can't.
We go through waves.
This has to be edited out. Like, I'll tell you later. Oh, yeah.
Conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest.
You're on the board.
I'm on the board. Yeah. No. Not yet. I'm trying to get on the board.
Got to make friends with Jack. I like Twitter, man. I do like Twitter. I like YouTube, too. Okay, questions on your mind. If you were starting a new project today, what framework would you use?
Next.js.
All right, same. I'd like to hear your talk about Rescript, the Reason rebrand. Any opinions about that?
I didn't know it was being rebranded until I heard that.
Did you ever use Reason at all?
No.
Yeah, I'm surprised, because that's like functional, and you're a huge functional nerd.
No, but...
Well, let's just be honest, you're a nerd, period.
It's...
You've used...
I have to be able to build an app.
Recoil. You've used Recoil, Reason,
but not
Reason.
React. I haven't used Recoil in a production app.
New rule for Ryan. Ryan, any framework or library that starts with R,
you have to use it
and be the one to evaluate it.
I did use Ramda.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. You're like Ramda Ryan over there.
Can I use
your nickname?
What?
Ramda Ryan? I feel like we might get... like a NC-17 rating. Like, welcome to Front End First, hosted by Sam and Ramda Ryan. And they like have like a bowl noise.
All right, next question.
All right, so you have some homework this weekend.
What?
Use Reason / Rescript and then Ramda Ryan it up in here afterwards. Question, why SAS is not trendy but PostCSS is? Question, how to solve with PostCSS what SAS did fine, nesting variables. All right. SAS is not trendy because it's big, and it's big. You have to like set it up.
You have to set it up. I mean, every project I've ever worked on, I've had to set up SAS.
But you have to set up PostCSS too. Okay, but SAS is like a language. It's a superset, but it's also like a language. And it's like once you go SAS, you... I was like...
Yeah.
same wavelength Friday afternoon. The whiskey's kicking in. See, they don't know. They didn't see what we started off with. Once you go SaaS, that's it for your app. PostCSS is like more compositional, and it's like, oh, I'll just add a little plugin so I can do imports. I'll add a little plugin so I can use some Tailwind directives, and but I can still write the rest of my CSS the same way. So I feel like that mental model is more like you can get PostCSS in, just slide it right in there, and then it and then do your thing, and you don't affect the rest of your the way you're writing styles. And so, he says how to solve nesting and variables. Well, variables are part of CSS now, so that's how you should do it. There's also a PostCSS plugin that lets you do it basically like you can in SAS, and there's a nested plugin that lets you do nesting with PostCSS. So PostCSS is like Babel for CSS.
That's what I was going to ask.
And it basically looks at your stuff, and if it finds little things that aren't part of CSS but that are referenced by a PostCSS plugin, it transforms them. That's why when it comes across at Tailwind Utilities, it just replaces all those with your generated utilities based on your config, and it can look at things and do nesting as well. So you can this person who's asking this, Eduardo Aranda, you can use nesting variables with PostCSS. That's basically when I was confused about this because we use SAS on everything forever. Yep. And we met Adam and we started using Tailwind, and he was like, why are you still using SAS? And I was like, I don't know. That's what you do when you make a website. And he was like, you don't need to do that. And I was like, how do I nest my rules back when I wrote CSS like a chump? And he was like, well, you just install PostCSS and add PostCSS nested. And I was like, that sounds like a lot of work. Why don't I just use SAS? And he's like, it's not a lot of work. So I did it. And then I was like, okay, yeah, this is actually nice not having like to install like some crazy C library to compile my SAS, which always like gave me errors.
Yeah.
Running NPM install.
No jip.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one. And so you don't have to do any of that stuff anymore. So these days I don't even write CSS, so it doesn't matter. So that's really the answer.
See, that's yeah. That's the what's the guy that's
yeah,
the like
meme, yeah. Yeah, that's yeah. Don't need SAS or post CSS if you don't write CSS. Okay, we're just knocking these out one after the next. Ram to Ryan and Speedy Sam. Okay, we'd love to hear your thoughts on use effector deploying static sites to the edge. Do you host a podcast? What are your thoughts on functional programming? Actually, we kind of answered that one in this one. And then looking forward to hearing you guys talk about V10 Next.js. So, cool. Last one here was Swix was asking about editing videos. I'm definitely happy to talk about that. People usually ask, every time I post a video on YouTube, I usually get a lot of DMs about what mic I use and all this stuff. Just a quick 2-second answer. Just get an ATR 2100 Audio Technica. It's a USB dynamic mic. People are always confused because you want to get a condenser mic, but you want to get a dynamic condenser, which is like the mics we're talking on right now, because they cancel out ambient noise. You don't want to get a Blue Yeti because that's a condenser mic. It's good for like playing guitar or singing because it picks up the reverb, which you want in the way you would hear a concert at like an audio hall. But if you're doing a voiceover, you don't want that. So Audio Technica ATR 2100 is $100. Plugs right into your Mac. So you can use it as an audio source for your screencast. So those are synced up. And then if you're doing something like I do on my videos where I have footage, or like we do on our podcast, even like right here, we have a video version of the podcast on YouTube and it cuts between us when we talk. There's a feature in Final Cut Pro called Multicam, and there's something similar in Premiere. And basically that's how you do that. So you get the footage. There's different angles. It's made for like, think of a live sporting event or something where you're cutting back and forth, or a debate, like a hypothetical debate with people who are like going to be, maybe, you know, they're going to be like, you count up how many people like the one and like the other, and then the winner of that person becomes like the leader of the free world, something like that. So if you're watching two of those people like talking to each other in like a weird way, it's going to like cut back and forth. So they're called angles. So you have like angle one, and then you have angle two, and then you have like a third angle that's like a wide shot. And the editor can just hit one, two, and three to cut between them. So I just do footage, which is just me, my big mug full screen. I do the screen cast, which is like cast as angle two. And then I do an angle three, which I call a two up, where you have my mug and the cast, and you make them like 70% and you put them side by side. And that way, like, I can direct the viewer's attention by switching angles. So that's like the little tip right there. And then other than that, I mean, there's a million things. Actually, there was a good full stack radio episode where Adam talked about how he does screencasts, and he talked all about little tricks that he does for that kind of stuff. But, and then like, yeah, a Sony A6500 with a nice prime lens would be good if you want to start getting your face out there. And, you know, use some powder. I'm actually not at that point yet, but I've noticed I've been oily a little bit. My face has been a little greasy and it's just like shiny. So now I got to get a powder girl or something like that. I don't know. You want to be my powder girl?
No, nah, I'm gonna pass on that.
I'll just have like little outtakes at the ends, like Ram to Ryan coming in and powdering my face.
Jeez.
No. Too much?
A little
no, too or not much. Enough.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's probably a milestone for every YouTube creator to create that meta video, which yes. is how I make my videos. Yeah. So you're getting close.
I know, but it's also like kind of sad because it's like
People are interested about in
the content.
Oh, what font is that?
It's like you're like, I'm going to make money on the internet. What am I going to do? Sell a book. And it's like you get five pages in and you're tweeting about how you're writing a book. And people are like, I want to write a book for the internet. You're like, I'm going to make money on the internet by teaching people how to make money on the internet. I never want to be one of those people. I think that's like, you know what I'm saying? It just feels like a failure. Like you couldn't cut it as like an actual teacher of like whatever content you're teaching. So you just had to like go up a level.
Well, you just keep going up and up and up.
I know. There was just a tweet that was like, there's too many people who want to be Grubhub and not too many startups want to be the next Grubhub and not enough want to be the next McDonald's. And that's exactly that point. It's like McDonald's is the thing actually
that you want.
Yeah. That people want. So, no, I'm just, by the way, kidding. Happy to teach about anything video related because it is actually part of what I love about all this stuff. And I gave like a snarky answer. I said, how do you make videos? You start a video casting site and make videos every week for 3 years. But that is the truth. And we've learned a lot from that. You don't have to take 3 years. But I like it, obviously. And we have a lot of experience with it. And then more recently with the footage on YouTube, you know, I have a friend who's a cinematographer. I've been learning a lot from her. And like, there's so much good stuff on YouTube about, you know, we're trying to improve the quality here. So when we make dumb jokes, you know, we're lit correctly at the right color temperature. Anyways, yeah, any of those questions, happy to answer. But hopefully I don't just devolve into the meta
channel.
How to make programming videos.
Yeah,
I don't know. Make videos teaching people how to make programming videos. Yeah, I don't want to. Yeah. I'll do it a little bit. If it's 5% of what I do, that's okay. I like to think there's more to me than that.
I think it's cool. I think the process videos are cool.
No, I know they are. I'm just kidding. All right. Well, next week, Sam and Ryan are going to be back with a bottle of whiskey in our hands each. Probably not each, but I think right here would be quite nice, right? Right here out of frame. Oh, look at that. Oh, just kidding. I was joking as if there was a bottle there, but there isn't.
Okay, we need to cut you
time off. To wrap it. Thank you all for joining us again. If you're just new here, we just talk about, I'm not going to say anything because you just listened to us for an hour. So thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.